why did you give up your U.S. citizenship?
So I'd always wanted to renounce my citizenship. I'd mentioned it when I was 13 years old. There's a growing number of people who are doing this. You know, it's only going to get worse.
Serial entrepreneur and investor, also known as the nomad capitalist.
The one and only Andrew Henderson.
He has successfully reduced his tax rate from 43% down to 1%.
And finally, I just said, you know, the country's moving in the wrong direction.
The media says, oh, people just don't want to pay taxes.
Yeah, it makes sense.
If you're an American, you want to qualify for the tax exemptions and exclusions. You have to actually...
All right. Andrew, thanks for coming on the show.
Good to be here.
So first question for you is, why did you give up your U.S. citizenship?
There's a growing number of people who are doing this. It's still small in the grand scheme of things, but you're seeing a lot of successful people who have international lives do this. I think they all have different reasons. The media says, oh, people just don't want to pay taxes because the U.S. has this policy called citizenship-based taxation, which means that you're going to have to file a tax return and be liable for tax no matter where you live in the world. And so people say anyone who gives up their citizenship must be doing it for tax reasons. And no doubt, I think it's a very unfair policy. The U.S. is really the only country that applies that in such a uniform way. I think you're seeing other countries starting to kind of tiptoe their way in through the back door to that kind of policy. But I was an entrepreneur, and therefore there were things that I could do to legally reduce, eliminate, and defer my tax liability. And I think that because of the system that I've set up, I could have continued to do that pretty effectively. I saw, you know, since I was 12 or 13 years old, my father would come home and he would show us articles from the Wall Street Journal. We would talk about how the U.S. was, you know, losing a spot in economic freedom, or the U.S., you know, education system was going down another couple rungs. Everything was just kind of moving in the wrong direction. He said, there's going to be a time when you might want to live somewhere else if you're going to be successful. And I've watched that, being aware of those conversations over the last quarter of a century. And I just said to myself, you know, it's only going to get worse. An empire that is pressured when its currency is less and less the world reserve currency, when people are increasingly moving out, when the countries that I'd seen all around the world are going to be more and more competition, they're not going to go down without a fight. I'm a pretty libertarian free market guy. You would think that there'd be a lot of things that Trump and I would agree on. There's some things we don't agree on. What we don't agree on is this kind of America first, not in America first, like, okay, that's so terrible. Although, when did the U.S. ever put itself last? I mean, Germany not paying its bills, I guess. Everything else, I think the U.S. is a pretty selfish country. But I kind of saw that in some of the policies he talked about. This is going to be bad for expats. And so I'd always wanted to renounce my citizenship. I'd mentioned it when I was 13 years old. This seems unfair. Maybe I'll give up my citizenship one day. I thought about it for years. And finally, I just said, you know, the country's moving in the wrong direction. They're going to come up with some new crazy policy. They're going to try and make lives more difficult. It's already getting difficult with a growing company and filing tax return. Not the actual taxes themselves, but just the paperwork required. There was an anxiety of like, what if I make one mistake? It's not like even a country like Ireland in the West, but certainly in Malaysia, where you make a teeny tiny mistake, you know, you didn't mean to, and okay, just fix it. People get in trouble in the U.S. They go after people. And I just said, why do I want to hang around for this? I don't need the passport. I didn't enjoy, you know, going places as an American. I suppose I still have the accent. I hosted a party in Vienna a year and a half ago when my own party guests, two of them, lectured me that because I sound like an American, that I'm responsible for all the world's atrocities. And at least I could tell them, well, I gave up one of the world's best passports. What have you done? Right? You still have your Austrian passport. You still have, and maybe Austria isn't as complicit, but, you know, how dare you, right? That was a good feeling to be able to say, I stepped away from that kind of stuff because I've seen the pain that the U.S. Has put on people in a lot of other countries. And so I just didn't want to be part of that. I don't need to be part of it. I don't want to live in the U.S. Our clients who are American are nice and like-minded, but that's a very, very small slice of the pie. I have no desire to be around most Americans. So why keep it when there's a risk?
Yeah, it's an interesting response. I think a lot of people may have those same feelings that you do, but they stick around. They are, you know, some would say loyal to the country. You know, you have this phrase that's go where you're treated best. And I think that's a key kind of rebuttal to that. But what about what would your argument be for those people that are saying you're abandoning your country? You should have stayed loyal and fight and stayed in your country to fix the laws or to fix the politics and the issues that are happening in your country.
Well, first of all, those people, when someone moves to their country from Iran or from El Salvador, wherever else, I understand that they're more frustrated with that now than they would have been 20 years ago because of the economic issues. But they take that as a badge of honor. Those people are leading their country. They're not staying and fighting for their country. In some cases, some of those countries, the U.S. is the one that screwed up their country in some regard. So somehow when people leave other countries and go to the United States, that's a good thing. But if you leave the United States, it's a bad thing. That maybe it should be a level playing field. I look at it as, you know, I spent a lot of time thinking of, you know, personal development stuff and building self-awareness. I mean, if you're going to be in a relationship, you better love yourself first. You can't let someone else love you and fix it. Or like being on a plane, put your mask on first and help the person next to you. The idea that you're going to be loyal. What has the government done for you? You saw it during COVID. That's why our business exploded during COVID, because people who had those thoughts were like, wait a second, I'm Australian. I've paid my taxes my entire life. Maybe I've never complained about it. We got people who weren't upset about paying taxes during COVID. They were upset that they went on a holiday somewhere and their own citizens, not only did their country lock them out, they couldn't come back, but their own citizens were like, yeah, serves you right for taking a holiday, you jerk. Like, okay, really? That's what you get for citizenship. Now, I'm a citizen of a number of small countries. Some I have kind of a personal connection to, some I do not. Do I think that St. Lucia is going to go out and screw with people for the fun of it? No, I don't think it's in their DNA. And so maybe I'd be more likely to fight for that. Yes, listen, I've got a citizenship of a country that I thought about it when the Russia-Ukraine war started. And I said, if there was a war here, you know, I'm probably not the guy you want in the front line. But would I go and contribute something? I'd be much more willing to do that. The small country where, you know, people, you know, there's a certain kind of social understanding. And so I'm not saying, you know, I'd be much more like that. I would say never be loyal to any government. They'll never be loyal to you. But certainly small countries are better. The United States is not even a country to some levels. It's a corporation. It's an empire. You're just kind of a subject of the empire there to do its bidding. You're there as someone whose name they can rack up debt so they can go, you know, fight wars that benefit, you know, the political class, which is why Washington, D.C. and suburbs is the wealthiest part of the country. And it used to be. But it is because of all the graft, of all the corruption. Most people don't care about you. They laugh at you. And so I just never understood, especially being born in Ohio, like we lived on the lake for part of my childhood, on Lake Erie, across which is Canada. Had I been born in the middle of that lake or on the other side of it, not very far away in the grand scheme of things, I'd be Canadian. And then like, oh, to hell with the U.S., let it burn because that's not my country, because my parents maybe again took a holiday. Maybe they were in Canada. I would have been born in Canada. I would have been a Canadian citizen. That's how it works there. So I it just seems like such a miracle of birth where we're born. I don't share the values of a lot of people in the U.S., and it's getting worse every day. People tell me it's gotten a lot worse since I left. Why would I fight for people when Gen Z thinks 30% of Gen Z surveyed said you should put security cameras inside your home and your privacy is irrelevant because it will stop a few instances of domestic violence. Obviously, domestic violence is a problem, but I'm going to fight for people whose values I don't represent. I think these people are nuts, quite frankly. The idea, first of all, that you're going to change the tide, there's a certain narcissism about that, with all due respect, that like in a country of 330 million people, 200 million, I suppose, eligible voting, if not more, eligible voters, really, like your vote. We do this thing where like I, as an entrepreneur, you have to realize that I'm good at being an entrepreneur, but it doesn't mean I'm good at everything. And you've got to check your ego. You've got to check your ego in the same way. Like, just because you believe something, probably most of the people don't believe that. And again, like we look at wealth tax, you know, socialized medicine in the US, like single payer, like all cancel rent, cancel mortgages, like all this stuff, it's gaining traction. Some of it's in the majority. You think everyone agrees with you? They don't agree with you. Like, what are you fighting for? It's this delusion that like everyone agrees with you. And if you just go after a few bad guys in the government, I never understood it. And I just think that if you take care of yourself, you'll have the better impact. look at people my age and younger in the US who are saying how much they're struggling. How much of an impact can they have in the world when they're struggling? Meanwhile, I'm here. Yeah, I pay less in taxes. I get to contribute more to charities, which are far more effective because I feel wealthier than I live in the US. And I get to have an impact. And I just got a note the other day. Hey, I was suicidal. I woke up every day and I watched your videos. It gave me hope. If you're not making an impact because you're held back by the system, what are you fighting for?
Yeah, I think it's confusing for some people because it's not comparing the U.S., let's say, to, you know, a place like Iran. The U.S. has,
for the last
century, been, you know, the top empire for this time period, right? You've had kind of the Netherlands initially, the U.K., and now it's the U.S., and then China's kind of creeping up there. I don't know if you've read the book, The Changing World Order by Ray Dalio, but he talks about how the rise and the fall of empires and the fall generally contribute to printing money, internal conflicts, weak leadership, kind of civil war and internal issues that are happening, large debts, obviously. And the counter argument, I guess, to what you're saying is that the U.S. ticks the box on all of those. And you can obviously see, it's not that U.S. is going to go away today or tomorrow. I think it's still going to be a power for a long time. But the argument is that it is certainly a declining place. But are you saying people should go to China then? Because China,
that's the common kind of
rise, right?
That's the rebuttal. And so here's what's interesting, right? Like whenever you want to figure out what you are in life or who you are, you should probably ask someone else that you trust and that has some good, you know, discernment, and ask them like, hey, am I this or am I that? Because like we're all conditioned as human beings to be like, oh, of course I'm a nice person. Like, well, if everyone else says you're not a nice person, like you're probably not a nice person. I mean, there's a lot of countries in Europe. Those people don't all want to move to the United States. I mean, remember Trump said, you know, why do we have the Norwegians? You know, why do we need to have the better people? And it's like, yeah, they don't want to come because they think their country's better. And I don't agree with crazy high taxes, but statistically, at least they get something for their taxes. At least there is like a greater form of cohesion there. And I, you know, like, why would they want to come? So if a Norwegian or many other people in Europe and other Western countries look at the U.S., like, this isn't the best. So already the answer, like, well, they go to China. That's not what's best. I pushed back on living in an empire. Why do you want to live in an empire? Here's what living in an empire does. It gives people who have no other identity something to feel good about. I like to judge myself and other people based on what they've done, based on who they are, based on my relationship with them. So for me, I'm an entrepreneur. I talk about nomad capitalism. I spread a message that I think has helped a lot of people. Not everyone agrees with it, but I've seen people that come to me at our annual event, Nomad Capitalist Live, when we actually have asked Ray Dalio to speak. You know, they tell me some pretty emotional stories sometimes. And, you know, the idea that you should be happy because you're American and like that's what makes you good. You go around bragging like I'm an American and we've got the best country. Number one, statistically not true. There's no metric in which the U.S. is number one, not a single one, not even the most obese country in the world anymore. I think Mexico and a few islands beat them out. So you're not even number one. Prisoners per capita. You beat China on that. So statistically, you're number one in nothing. That has to count for something. Yes, I understand thoughts and feelings and emotions. That's fine. Some people have it. Admit that you have an emotional connection to your country. Your emotions don't make it number one. Just like you can be in a relationship with someone, but the fact that you love them does not make them quantitatively the most beautiful person in the world. Not saying don't have the relationship, but I'm saying like if you've deluded yourself to be in that relationship that like, oh, this is, you know, don't do that. So what people do because they are emotional about it is they're like, yeah, move to Somalia. Like, yeah, there's 251 other sovereign countries and territories, and some of them are Norway, where the taxes are high, but things generally work. Some of them are adjacent to that, like in Ireland, where people always say, oh, they've got crazy high taxes. Yeah, not if you're a foreigner. They've got a regime for foreigners, so you don't have to pay the crazy high taxes, so that could work. So that generally works there. Then you've got these kind of places like the UAE, where they do have a corporate tax for many businesses now, but it's still, you know, zero or low tax, depending on what you do. I mean, there's so many places to go, and that's where I've spent my time over the last, you know, 12 years. And somehow I've been died I haven't, you know, suffered some terrible malady or my life hasn't been substantially worse. In fact, everybody I bring, I just brought one of my friends here to Colombia. He's like, why am I dating women where I'm from? You know, why aren't I here? I mean, I think that the emotional response of then go live in Somalia. First of all, Somalia is probably just like a little bit better than the average person thinks it is. There are people living there. Like there are people doing business. Americans have gone back there. Actually, I think that it was the president of Somalia who gave up U.S. citizenship. We should have come with the former one. But it's just so reactionary to say like, well, that's where you should go. Okay. I'm going to go to Ireland or I'm going to go to Malaysia. And maybe one is a better brand than the other. But have you been to Malaysia? Have you been to Kuala Lumpur? Have you been to the neighborhood? By the way, I could say, oh, then go to West Virginia. Like, go to that poorest county where the average person makes $10,000 a year. There's places in Malaysia that make more than West Virginia, like at the capital city. So I just think it's so emotional. And people need that to define themselves. Maybe I'm a little bit further than most people in actively not wanting to define myself as American. But I don't understand why defining yourself is that helps you. And I think from that comes a lot of emotions, which I'm an emotional person, but it's never good to make decisions based on emotions.
So let's say you get there as a U.S. citizen or a Canadian, or it doesn't have to be American, right? You just are not enjoying the places that you live. What are the considerations that someone should think about when they're choosing the next place? How did you think about what was the next place for you? And how did you go into that conclusion?
I was very nomadic. There's a couple different ways you can live. So there's the plan A, which is I'm going to move now and I'm going to get out and I'm going to have an adventure and I'm going to enjoy, whether it's lower cost of living, lower taxes, you know, the guy who wants to date the more beautiful, nicer women, whatever. That's plan A. I'm going to move. Plan B is I want to have residence permits, citizenships, bank accounts, things set up so that I can get out when I think the fur is going to start flying. I do think it's a bit dangerous because how much advance warning do you often get, whether it's they're going to raise your taxes or whether it's something terrible is going to happen down the street. But having a plan B is at least better. Robert Kiyosaki told us, you know, 3 days. Where can you get in 3 days? So if you're doing plan A, you can go from moving to one place. And if you're going to move to one place, you can make it, hey, I'm going to try this for a year. And if it doesn't work, I'm going to the second place on the list, because you don't want to lock yourself in, because that's a recipe for I'm going to come back. I'm going to give up. And you're going to say, oh, that didn't work. Well, you went to one place. You can move to a couple places. Like I created the trifecta method. I'm in Colombia right now. I've got a small home here. I have, you know, larger places in other parts of the world, such as Malaysia. And you can divide your time up, which could be tax optimized, depending on where you're from. But for me, it's lifestyle optimized. It gives you a taste of the different parts of the world. You never get bored. You know, if you're not as good at speaking Spanish, you know, you can deal with that for a while. Maybe you get frustrated after a while. That's when you leave, that kind of thing. Or you can just do what I started, which is being totally nomadic. I remember my very first, you know, trip, I spent a month in each country. I did just hang out and go to juice bars. I interviewed, you know, CEOs of banks. As the nomad capitalist very early on. And I interviewed people who were in investment and who were, you know, doing stuff like that, starting businesses. So you can slow travel or fast travel as fast or slow as you want, or you can pick a few places to start, or you can pick one place, or you can pick one place and then eventually, you know, say, hey, I want to get other places because I'm traveling part of the time. I mean, there's no right or wrong way to do it. What I've seen that I didn't entirely understand at the beginning was I now optimize for some sense of efficiency and for kindness. So parts of Eastern Europe, not as kind. Certainly, I think it's more of a freedom mindset, much more direct, which I do like. So you want to find the place, if you're going to go to that part of the world that has a nice balance of freedom, directness, you know, getting stuff done, people who are welcoming, but also, you know, have some kindness. I think Georgia is a good example. Service isn't great. Kindness among people that you know is some of the best. If you've got a friend, they'll do anything for you, and you can make friends easily enough. That's why I've talked about Georgia. Colombia, people are extremely kind. I think in a number of places in Latin America, but especially Colombia for me. Malaysia, extremely kind. And are they the most efficient places in the world? No, but I'm optimizing for some balance of that. You've got enough services in a country of 35 or 40 or 60 million people to where you can get some stuff done. They either have, you know, local Amazon, or in Colombia, they have actual Amazon. You know, those are two things that I look at. Contrary to popular belief, I do not over-optimize for taxes. I do think there's something about the fact that, like in Malaysia, which has a territorial tax system, which means foreign income isn't generally taxed. So if you've got a foreign business, maybe in some cases, like your salary, if you're living there full-time, will be taxed. You pay yourself a salary as an employee of the business. The business itself generally wouldn't be taxed. There's other rules, CFC, PEL. A territorial system is, you know, you're not going to pay much. I kind of think there's a connection between a country where the government's pretty open, they respect everybody, they're non-prejudicial. You know, if I go on an American passport and today I go on a St. Lucian passport, they don't treat me any differently. In fact, it's actually easier to St. Lucian or something else. I think that kind of indicates why they have a policy that's more friendly on immigration, more friendly on taxes. But I don't over-optimize for that. I do like to have my company set up in pretty tax neutral places, and then I just move the lever up and down based on how much tax, you know, I want to pay personally, and then let the business be tax neutral. So, you know, there's places in Europe that have very good tax deals. I'm not a supporter if you have to pay zero. But I also think that, you know, I would not move to any place. If you've got a 7 or 8 figure income, I mean, for me personally, I don't know that I'm ever going to get $8 million a year worth of roads and bridges and schools. I don't ask for public services like healthcare. I don't get that. I don't expect that. I don't want that. I wouldn't send my kids to the public schools if I had them. I pay petrol tax, gas tax to drive on the roads, whether I'm driven or, you know, whether I'm driving, which I don't. So if you're a pretty successful person, there comes a point when, you know, Italy charging you 100,000 euros a year flat tax as a foreigner who hasn't lived there, or an Italian who's coming home after many years, that seems pretty fair. You're paying a lot more than most people. And I think that's what you should optimize for on the tax side. But on the lifestyle side, kindness, efficiency, and language, I would say, is one people probably overestimate their ability to learn a new, or their willingness to learn a new language.
Yeah, especially as you get older, right?
Yeah.
So you mentioned setting the kind of the plan A, plan B. So within the US particularly, there's an exit tax, right? You mentioned 2 million being the kind of the magic number. Can you explain why 2 million is the magic number?
So yeah, so let me explain. We've talked about this on our YouTube. I've written it in my book. So a lot of countries have an exit tax when you leave their tax system. The difference, as we mentioned, between the US and other tax systems is to entirely leave the US tax system, you have to give up US citizenship. So you can move to Puerto Rico, and that's good for certain people. I think most people don't really want to live in Puerto Rico. There's not a lot of people who I've talked to as clients who are like, yeah, Puerto Rico, here I come. Not efficient. But that's one option. You're still a U.S. taxpayer, but you're under a different system. So if you want to go to the U.S. tax system, basically they say, hey, while you were a taxpayer, if you accumulated more than $2 million in assets, or you had a very high amount of income that you had a high federal tax burden on, I think it's up to about $900,000 of federal income tax in the last 5 years, or you have not been compliant in your taxes, then we're going to deem you a covered expatriate. We're going to tax you. We're going to apply an exit tax, which is basically a capital gains tax on all unrealized capital gains. It's their last bite at the apple. I'm not a big fan of tax, but people make it out like it's some punitive thing. If you would have continued to be a taxpayer your entire life, they would have gotten the money from you eventually. They're basically saying, well, you're going to leave, so just pay us now. If you have less than $2 million in assets, or, you know, you don't meet the other criteria as well, then you can get out. So if you bought your Bitcoin, you know, 2 cents, and you know, now it's up to 1.9 million, I guess now is the time, right? Because once you get to 2 million, that whole unrealized capital gain is going to be liable, whether it's a long-term, short-term, whatever. So what they're basically just saying is, before you go, pay us now. And there's some strategies that you can use to kind of push that out a little bit. But, and obviously, you know, different things have different valuations. A stock, pretty cut and dry. A business, you know, debatable, potentially. You know, private company. So it's just them saying you accumulated a bunch of stuff while you were here. Now, what makes it unfair for the U.S. is, you know, for a guy like me, I started Nomad Capitalist when I was living overseas. And Nomad Calpus now is the vast majority of my wealth. Now, I left when it was much smaller, and so I got a pretty good deal in that regard. But this is why, if you're an American,
was it 20% that you had to pay?
But it's whatever the capital gain is.
Okay.
Right. So yeah, I mean, it depends. It's just whatever would be owed eventually. And by the way, it could be difficult because, you know, if you're trading, you know, meme stocks or something, and you decide to renounce, you know, that could be a short-term gain. So, I mean, the rate can fluctuate, but yeah, I mean, you're probably somewhere in the 20s, with all the different, you know, stuff. So what's unfair is if you build a business overseas and then you want to renounce. They think, well, that's still there. Now, if you're Australian, if you're Canadian, they also have exit taxes. But that comes when you not give up your citizenship. You just leave the country and become what we call tax not resident. You can keep your passport in those cases. And they're getting stricter. Australia, we talked about this last year. They're getting kind of strict. Like, hey, if you don't live overseas the way we like, maybe we'll just keep taxing you. And that's, you know, why holding a Western passport, I think, is increasingly dangerous, because they're the ones doing that. When they're the ones finding more ways to claw you back into the system. But you can get out of the tax system in most other Western countries, but many of them have exit taxes that are kind of the same. So the deal is, if you plan on being overseas, you know, get out as soon as you can. This is what you're seeing, like Bitcoin's gone crazy this year. I was telling people when it was down like 20 grand, I said, okay, like, now's the time. If you think this is the bottom, get out now, because you're going to pay the capital gain. Or maybe you've got capital loss and then you have no. I mean, if you renounce the $100 million and you sold the business and already paid the tax, you don't pay more. If you've got a capital loss, you know, if you have $100 million, but you still have $200 million, like, you don't, you know. So it's always good to get out before stuff goes up. And I think that, you know, that's why doing the plan A earlier is good. Because you get out there and you realize, hey, this is pretty good. And I love, we have more Western people on our team these days. We bring them to our event, Nomad Calpus Live in Malaysia. We just did a team building thing here in Colombia. We travel all over the place. And these people are like, wow, this is a lot better than where I'm from. I'm not getting my money's worth. So you have to kind of get out there and explore and realize there are better options across the whole spectrum. And I think that because people don't do that, they wait too long and then they get sucked up in this exit tax, where if you're a young person and you just don't have a lot of money and you get out there and spend 5 years and you build your $2 million, if you're American, I mean, you're going to be in a decent position. You can say, do I want to be a citizen or not? And by the way, you could choose to live in one of these tax-friendly European countries for the first 5 years. And you could get a passport within 5 or 6 years by then, really good U.S. quality passport. So these are all the things that I think about, but yeah, governments are not just going to let you accumulate money while you're on their tax plantation and then leave without paying them their slice.
Yeah. Just to go into the taxes a little bit more. So there's this 183-day rule that people follow. Let's say you've given up your U.S. citizenship, and obviously this varies, right? For yep. Canadian, Australians, and so forth. And it's kind of the rule that if you don't spend 183 days, not the rule, I would say, but the belief that you don't have to pay taxes in that place. So if you're, let's say, doing the trifecta, let's say someone models your trifecta list 4 months in 3 different countries.
Right.
Where do they pay taxes? Like, where do you personally pay taxes?
So there's a couple things. The 183-day rule is a very misunderstood rule. Maybe it applied more in like 1972 or something. So here in Colombia, as I understand it, and we have a whole team of R&D people. We've got a guy, this guy's a madman on tax, understanding tax non-residents and tax treaties and all that. But my belief last time I looked at it was here in Colombia, it's a very simple day's test. There's not really other tests. And certainly not for a foreigner who wasn't born here. So if you spend 183 days, you're the tax net. If you don't, you're not. So that right there is a misconception. People say, why did you buy a home in Colombia? The taxes are crazy. Number one, there's some of the lowest taxes in the OECD, which is not a great club to be in, but it's among the lowest among high tax places. And I'm not here. I never planned to be here 183 days. And that's not because I don't want to pay tax, although I don't want to pay Colombian tax. I never had the need or the desire to spend that much time in South America. It is not my primary continent. And so for me to come here, hire some people, put some money into the economy, I would never be liable for tax. And that's because I'm not going to do the 183. Now, Western countries, that's where the real misconception comes in. The DAZE test may be one of two, three, four, or more different tests. And it may be taken kind of in a whole, you know, fact pattern. So sure, if you spend 183, and it may be off by a day or two in some countries, but if you spend that 183, you lose. But just because you don't doesn't mean you win. Because they might say, oh, but you still have an apartment here, or you have a car here, or whatever. And perhaps in some countries, it's harder if you're from there, right? Like it might be harder for me to go and get into the tax net than it would be, it'd be harder for me to get into the tax net than it would be for someone to you know, get out of it, right? If you know what I mean. Like there's kind of a presumption, like you've lived here your entire life, like, okay, show us that you're not here. So the 183 is a bad issue. Now, there are some countries you can sign up for special tax residence programs if you're under 6 months, where this is what we do for our clients. We don't always talk about all of them. Some of them aren't, you know, we get to go crawling through the laws and translating things. But some of them, it's like, hey, if you invest $500,000 and you spend one day a year here, we'll give you tax residence. And there's a few things you can do to be compliant, or give us $20,000 and spend 30 days. Or if you spend more time here than anywhere else and you remit a certain amount of money, or spend 15 days and pay us this amount. Like there's a number of programs like that for mobile people. Now you can't spend 15 days, on some island and then go and spend, you know, 300 days in Australia. Like that's obviously not allowed. You can't do that. But for someone who's globally mobile, that could work. It's possible that depending on where you go for the trifecta, one of the countries could say, hey, if you spend this amount of time and you remit this amount of money, like that could work also. Or you could have a kind of like a fourth country that's just like a vacation. I mean, there's a number of different ways to do it. It's possible. I mean, I'm thinking like Ireland, for example. After 2 years, 280 days, you're a taxpayer. It's a pretty simple DAZE test, 183 in a year, 280 over 2 years. So that's little over 4 months, closer to 5 months. So you could kind of modify the trifecta a little bit, and you could do that. And Ireland has a pretty flexible tax system for people who, you know, are not considered domiciled in Ireland, where you would just pay tax on the money that you remit to Ireland. So there's a number of different systems. There's that, there's remittance-based systems, there's lump sum-based systems, which kind of a flat fee. Italy, for example, or Greece would be examples of that. So I think that the DAZE test is greatly misunderstood, again, both in terms of how easy it is to get out of a Western country, as well as why am I in Colombia for 2 to 4 weeks a year? That doesn't do anything for me. Doesn't affect me negatively. So that's what you want to be aware of. It can get intricate. This is why our service is very multi-jurisdictional. We have all the experts in all different places, and we kind of understand how things work together, because I found it very difficult myself to like put the puzzle pieces together. And that's what I've spent my life trying to help people do, because I've seen how frustrating it can be. There's a lot of nuance to it, but that's kind of the overview.
So for someone that's in that situation that is spending in a place of generally like not in a Western place, are you saying that's legally a way to pay pretty much zero taxes?
Yeah, I mean, there's places you can go and live full time and pay zero taxes, either because they just don't have taxes. Again, the UAE, I don't think for anyone with a business would be in that category anymore, but you've got other countries in that part of the world that are zero tax, other countries in other parts of the world that are zero tax. A territorial country, depending on how you're structured and what you do, could essentially be zero tax. So you could live in any number of places and pay zero tax full time. And hey, if the country doesn't ask for tax, I don't see anybody volunteering to pay more. I think I saw in the UK a couple of years ago, 12 people contributed like an extra £20,000 in voluntary gifts. So the country's not asking for the money there. But yeah, if you like the trifecta lifestyle, which I was motivated by the lifestyle, because I see so many opportunities around the world, that the idea of only being in Asia, it's like I'm missing something somewhere else. And I like Peruvian food, and they don't have good Peruvian food here. Like, and yeah, this and that.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're dopamine motivated as I am, and you want to keep moving to some extent, that works. But yeah, I mean, by the way, if you're an American, you always have U.S. tax residents. And so if your trifecta as an American was Malaysia, Colombia, Georgia, none of those countries, I don't think, would generally speaking tax you. And then you just deal with the U.S., which is kind of a good thing for the U.S. Like just deal with them. Like don't have them in some other country fighting. It gets really messy. And so, I mean, if you are a trader or an investor, you're screwed. If you're a business person, you can defer a lot of tax. You can pay probably a single digit or very low double digit rate. And so if you value a U.S. passport, you could always do that. If you're not U.S., then yeah, you could you'd probably get it down to zero.
Where are some easy, like, tax-friendly spots for this situation? You mentioned Colombia as one of them, but for Latin America, let's say Europe and Asia, could you kind of name two or three countries that would, you know, if you spend less than 183 days in general, you'd be good?
Yeah, I mean, Colombia is not tax-friendly. It just happens to be if it's a part-time residence, that you won't be into the tax system. Now,
if you're doing
the one thing is, Colombia is a wealth tax. Do you have 3.54 billion Colombian pesos, something like that, in Colombian assets, bank accounts, trading accounts, real estate? That you'd have to look out for, but that's not so bad. I think most countries could be friendly under that scenario. The Western countries, I mean, we had a guy, hey, I want to spend 4 months in Germany. I own an apartment. I'm thinking of buying a car. I remember talking to the German tax guy, oh, that's terrible. That's a terrible idea. Because even though 4 months is under the limit, like that, he's really starting to make a case that they can look at and say, you know, you're a problem. We had a guy once get a letter from HMRC, the UK tax authority, just because he went to visit his girlfriend every weekend. And they're like, hey, do you owe us money? Like, they track this stuff. So I think outside of the Western world, there's a lot of countries that are friendly. I would say, you know, if your goal is optimization of tax, Uruguay, for example, has a 10, really 11 year tax optimizations. If you decide, hey, I'm tired of the trifecta, so I'm living in Uruguay, you can do that. Paraguay is relatively tax friendly. Probably not for a lot of people. You know, Costa Rica has been tax friendly. Panama has been tax friendly. Ecuador kind of, sort of. So Latin America is not the most tax friendly. You've got some of the Central American countries, which have some of these territorial regimes and kind of threatening at times to get rid of them. You've got Uruguay, which has this long-term regime. In Europe, I mean, Georgia, you can call that Europe or not. It's got a pretty flexible tax regime. You pay 0 or 1%. Italy, Ireland, Greece, Switzerland, if you want to live there full-time, the UK just got rid of their program. They don't want anybody wealthy anymore. I think Western Europe is harder unless you're going to get into one of these regimes. So, hey, if you make 2 million euros a year, pay Italy 100,000, 5% tax. Not bad. And by the way, unlike some of the other countries, in 10 years, you can get a passport. It's a very good passport. Yeah. In Asia, Southeast Asia is pretty tax friendly, but that's more for wealth. So Latin America is easier for immigration based on, hey, I make $2,000 a month. Okay, come on in. And you can work towards citizenship. Asia doesn't give citizenship. The taxes are friendlier, but they're like, hey, we want you to put $300,000 in the bank. It's a condition for getting in. Or you've got to pay us $50,000, or you've got to buy property, or whatever. So that's kind of the difference. But, you know, Malaysia is friendly. Thailand isn't quite as friendly as it used to be, but it's kind of on this non-dom system in a kind of way now, which to me, if you like Thailand, great. But if you could go to Ireland and get one of the best passports in the world in 5 years, which you can't in Thailand, you know, maybe that's better. So there's so many moving pieces. I mean, which levers are most important to you is the question. But those are some countries.
Yeah. I'm assuming most people that go to Europe for 3 months out of the summer, let's say, they're not going to be triggered for any taxes or anything like that if they're doing the whole trifecta method.
I mean, obviously, we're not giving tax advice here. There's probably some scenarios where they would be. There's tax treaties, and depending on where you are, tax resident, but there's a whole number of things to consider. I don't want people to take this, obviously, as tax advice. We help people with this. You can call anybody you want, but just, you know, call someone to get some help. But if you're a genuine, you know, vacationer. Now, for me, what I've enjoyed is owning lifestyle real estate around the world. It's a part of just kind of diversification for currencies, and it gets you residence permits or citizenship sometimes. So I kind of like buying property for those reasons. And I, as I've kind of grown in my business, I think it's also kind of level of asset protection, having property in different places. And so, I mean, if you own a property in Europe, I mean, that may be one strike against you, which is why my initial property was in Montenegro. And I'm in the process of selling that. Montenegro is much more tax friendly and tax flexible than, let's say, you know, other countries. But, you know, now if you look at a country like Greece, you're going to get a better quality villa. It's just that they've left the rack And if you ended up, you know, getting stuck into the tax system forever, you could always just sign up for their lump sum and pay some fixed low rate of tax. So, yeah, I mean, Western Europe is a good place to vacation. Even Monaco is not quite as friendly and easy as people think it is. It's a pain in the butt to get in there. So, yeah, if you want to spend a lot of time in Western Europe, I would suggest having some kind of plan that maybe involves paying some tax to Western Europe. That's not advice for everybody, but that's kind of what I would do personally if I wanted to be in Western
Europe. Yeah. You mentioned having real estate property everywhere. I'm curious to get your decision on this whole buying versus renting thing. I've kind of listened to a lot of people have this debate. Ramit Sethi particularly talks about the phantom costs of owning real estate, which is, you know, the maintenance, the insurance, property tax, realtor fees, all of these different things. And by and large, you actually net out less profitable than just investing in the S&P 500. And obviously there's different reasons why people have properties, but for you particularly having real estate properties, was it an investment decision for you to grow your cash net positive?
Listen, I think people should invest for investment's sake and live for living's sake. And I think people try and conflate the things. I'll buy a place, I'll use it, but I'll Airbnb. Everything should have one purpose, I think. It's like when I met some girl many years ago, it's like, hey, come and live with me and like we'll give you a job. Like, listen, have the girlfriend for girlfriend's sake and have employees for like stop trying to mix it in together. Like you've got some secret plan or something. So I'm here in Colombia. I own an apartment. It's about 1,100 square feet. It's not, you know, the best apartment in the world, but here's what I get from it. Every time I come, my stuff's set up. I have all my accoutrements. I have the artwork that I want on the walls. I have my clothes. I have a wardrobe. I came here with a carry-on from Europe because I have sweaters. I have pants. I have suits. I have everything that's what I want to wear. I have my fragrances that I want to wear here. That's worth a lot just in terms of the anxiety saved of not schlepping stuff around the world. It's taken me a while. I have a system. I keep track of which sweaters I have in which house on Airtable. I've got, you know, pictures. I built quite a system, but I always know I'm arriving to something. I don't have to think about it. And so I'm not a guy. I mean, I've stayed at $1,000 a night hotels. I'm not a big hotel guy. I feel that they generally under deliver, particularly chains. Marriott just does a terrible job, even at their top 5-star properties. So for me to, you know, stay in a place that's equivalent to this, which might be a little bit nicer, but would lack some of the coziness of my own home, I'm probably paying $400 a night in Bogota. And if we look at since I bought the property, 3.5, something like that years ago, probably spent, 200 nights close to it, thanks to the pandemic. Right there, I've got probably a 40 or 45% return. And I just feel more productive. I just know things work. When the internet doesn't work at a hotel, you call and they scramble for 2 hours and nobody knows what to do because it's nobody's job. I know stuff works and I have enough employees around the world, or in this case, I have my renovation contractor who for $500 a year, he pays my bills once a month. I send him the money at the end of every year. Here's the expected bills. Here's $500 for your time. He's very gracious about it. He goes to the management board meetings for me. If anything is broken, he fixes it. He sends a maid over every once in a while to keep things clean. He comes before I arrive to make sure the internet is working in case something stopped or in case it's a leak or something, he fixes that. And the cost, I think, to maintain this property, property taxes are pretty low. There's 24-hour security in Colombia, but it's still very cheap in terms of maintenance. The electric and the water is practically nothing, especially if you're not here. It's probably $2,000 and change. So for like $2,600, $2,700 a year, including his fee, I have a property that's ready for me. I got a permanent residence permit, which allows me to live in Colombia as much as I want, but only have to spend one day every 2 years. I can work towards Colombian citizenship after 5 years if I want. If I learn Spanish, I've learned the history of the country. If I improve my Spanish, that Colombian permanent residence permit allows me as someone who no longer is a U.S. citizen and gives me one or two extra countries I can enter without having to go and get a visa. It's not a huge list anymore, but like Mexico is one example. I get to have an asset in Colombia. The market did come down, but I think I'm still ahead of the game. And I think that for all those reasons, I don't listen to the financial gurus because I have enough money to put in the S&P 500 or my equivalent of it. And I think it's a little small-minded to over-optimize every dollar at the expense of lifestyle. Now, if I only lived in one house in the United States, I can kind of, you know, see the point of that. I think that, you know, having continuity is worth something, particularly if you live my lifestyle. Of not, like, if I rented it and I like during the pandemic, I couldn't go there for 2 years. Like, what would I do? I'd just cancel the rental. What happens to my stuff? Like, it's just nice to know, like, things are waiting for you if you're a successful person. And I think that perhaps, obviously, you mentioned Ramit Sethi. I'm sure he's a very successful guy. But some of the people talking, it's like, you know, they make 50 grand, they make 100 grand. There's nothing wrong with that. I make more than 100 grand. So I'm already doing the things. Lifestyle real estate is a part of my pie of a, what I call the never be poor fund, that allows me to focus on my ultimate growth stock, which is my business.
Yeah.
It's
a small pot for you, right?
And I'm a frugal guy. You go ahead. Yeah.
No. I'm just saying if someone has $200,000 and you have to put cash up front to buy a place in Bogota, maybe like you want to think about what other options, but for you, it's a fraction. So it doesn't really affect your whole investments.
I'm a frugal guy and I do think there's a difference. I don't know, what I think about this, but like Dave Ramsey says, you spend more money on a credit card. Like just psychologically, when you use a piece of plastic, credit or even debit, he says, you don't think of it as much as money. Some people agree, some people disagree. But in the same way, I would kind of surmise when I buy a property here, especially because I got permanent residence, I spent the minimum, which isn't always the best idea because I could have gotten a bigger property, but I'm a frugal guy. And I have certain luxuries in life. A house I spend 2 weeks a year in wasn't one of them. So I spent like $162,000 or something. And so if I were to go and rent, would I rent something that cost $100? No, I wouldn't. I mean, I'd be at the $400 a night place. Would my life be better? Again, I might have a little bit higher ceilings or a little bit more, I don't know what. We did a video shoot in a place that was $400 a night. It felt sterile, honestly. It was nicer. Things are a little bit bigger, like more open spaces, but it felt a little sterile. And I spent so long. I'm the guy who bought houses after, I'm like lifetime platinum elite at Marriott. I'm this at other hotels. It was miserable, man. Like knowing that you're like at the whim of some hotel or service department people who don't care about you. Like they really like Airbnb started as sleep in my spare bedroom. Now it's people. It's like a Wall Street approach. They don't care about you. It's like, hey, what's the cheapest stuff we can put on the walls, or can we put nothing and get away with that? Like I just think it drains the lifestyle. So you'd have to spend so much if you're living my lifestyle too. Recapture the same, feelings of comfort that I have just owning the property. And I think that's worth something. I think, the same reason that, people send the CEO to get a massage once a week. I mean, it's just good for growing the business.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense. Speaking of CEOs, so I want to get into business a little bit. I personally have a business in the US, kind of getting in the 8-figure range now. And there's a lot of people in that situation, right? Very easy to set up in the US. People have an LLC, C Corp, whatnot. You talk often about relocating your business. Obviously, that's a different question than just starting a business in Dubai or wherever it might be, which is a separate conversation we can have after. But for those that are inside of the US already, what are the pros and cons? And just based on how difficult it is to move your company completely outside of the US, or are there better strategies?
Again, we're not giving tax advice. And the answer is it somewhat depends on the kind of business, right? So let me just give you a general example. A consulting business with you and a couple of employees might be easier to move than, from a tax perspective, than a business with 100 employees that are in the country and you have all kinds of assets. Not because the assets can't move, like a factory or something. I'm not talking about that. I'm saying, if you're going to move a business in most countries, you have to do an arm's length transaction. Now, in the US, actually, it may be easier than for some other Western countries, but you can't just say, hey, oh my God, this business that made $10 million last year, it's falling apart. You know what? Shut it down, sell it to parts, and I'll go to Dubai. I'll take all the assets. I'll click the customer list. I'll just pilfer everything and start fresh, and you can't get me. Generally, that's why, again, you want to move before the business becomes too big. because in many countries you have to sell the stuff to yourself. You can't just like, hey, you can't set up a company that's worth $50 million and then just, oh, it's worth nothing. Now, obviously, the reason why a consulting business could be better is like you don't have to work in your own business. You could always say, hey, like people don't understand, I think, that they are also effectively an employee in their own business. The employee you could just, I don't want to be here anymore. I'm going to go work somewhere else. That makes it easier. But the bigger your business gets, the harder it is to move, at least without paying a decent chunk of money. And so that's where there's a lot of analysis required when you're moving a business. One thing, if you're an American and you move overseas and you want to qualify for the tax exemptions and exclusions, they get your tax down to that single digit or low double digit, or even zero. For some Americans, it could be zero. Still a way to do that. You can't be the only person running the business. It has to be an actual business, not a profession. And so that's the kind of thing I'm talking with the U.S. There's just so many rules that can change at any time about how you reduce your taxes. But I mean, you have a business. The goal is get out sooner than later. We had a guy once, I'm sure we had many clients like this, but one stuck in my mind. He kept raising money. The last valuation was like $400 million. He owned, I don't know, 40%. At this point, the numbers are a little blurry for me. He couldn't afford to renounce. He had my reasons. He's like, you know what? I'm happy to pay him, but then I want out. But he literally didn't have the cash to pay it. So, I mean, some people are in that position. I mean, you know, there was a famous radio psychologist one time, some things can't be fixed. That's why you want to get the business out as soon as possible. Another thing you want to do to maybe prepare for that is, if you have employees in Western high-tax countries, there may be, you know, things about that drag you back into the tax net. I don't hire Americans. I love the opportunity of being able to find people in countries that maybe there aren't as many opportunities and bring them up to making a lot of money and being successful and learning from us. That's kind of the personal side. But from the tax side, why would I hire an American and subject myself? I mean, particularly in certain roles, maybe like a contractor or something that can work. But for a large number of like full-time particular sales roles, hiring in the US, Canada, et cetera, that's murder. You're dead. Not tax advice.
Company.
Right. Because like, you know, they figure these things out. So like I had a guy ask me once, and sometimes they just can't understand. Like, I'm just gonna be like, all right, you got me, you know, I'll change the tax law. But he's like, well, I'm gonna sit at my company in the British Virgin Islands and I'll just go there once a year and do my board meetings and then I won't pay tax as long as I don't bring the money into Canada where he lived. Yeah, they figured that one out. The company's managed from Canada. Therefore, it's taxed in Canada. Now, we've had some clients. I just think it's easier to run a BVI company or whatever. Or I want to hire everybody in my Singaporean company, but I live in the U.S. I'm happy to pay the tax. It's fine. You can do that. But you can't get out of that. And in the same way, yeah, you can't have all your people there. Now, there's staffing companies, there's EORs, you can do your own. I mean, we have some of that in emerging countries where we've got a staffing company, we pay a little bit of corporate tax, we pay the payroll tax, and that isolates those people from our main structure. That's the proper, you know, procedure. But I think it's harder in the Western world, and there's certain roles that are just going to be death. So yeah, like the idea that, again, like this stuff isn't easy. You have to actually commit to being offshore. And RHR, you know, Hatia gets a speech every year at Nomad Capitalist Live about the book, The Culture Map, which is incredible. And it helped us kind of understand different cultures and where we hire and where we don't hire and why. It's been a process of where to go and where to hire. But I think it's been, in the end, it's been rewarding. I look at what people are talking about in the U.S. and now Bernie Sanders wants to have a 4-day work week. And of course, everyone said, oh, it's going to be so much more productive. No, you won't. You won't. But of course, you're going to say that. Why do I want to hire people there? Like, I actually believe work is a good thing. Yes.
So what's the trigger for, let's say, a foreign company that's hiring people in the U.S.? Is there a number that would trigger that amount?
I'm not going to get into tax advice, but I think people should be very careful. I mean, listen, it could be one. It could be one, very well be one in some cases.
Okay, got it. Now, for people that maybe are just starting, maybe they just started the business or they are looking to start a business somewhere else outside of the U.S., where are the best places to go if it's not the U.S.? I think you mentioned Dubai as one of them.
Well, right. So, I mean, the number one thing at Nomad Capitalist is there is no best. I mean, it's what works for you. I mean, the UAE had free zones, which were tax-free. And especially if you're an American, I think your company probably, I mean, if I were an American, my preference would be to have a company that was 0% tax. And then I would just deal with the U.S. separately, rather than, again, mixing the two together. I think most people who are going to start companies these days in a UAE free zone are going to be dragged into the 9% tax. And now, you know, I said that a couple of months ago, and they kind of secretly put out like the new guidance. And everyone's like, no, he's crazy. It's going to, oh, yeah. And now they're like actually like the Instagram, like, oh, actually, you really want to pay 9%. Like, oh, okay, it's changed.
okay.
I mean, if you want to live in the UAE,
yeah,
they're going along with the global minimum tax, which doesn't affect your company or my company. It affects Facebook and big companies. But the UAE is like, all right, we don't want to be a pariah. We don't want, you know, we want to be friendly with everybody. They said they want to be overly friendly. So they said, okay, we'll put in a 9% tax. Don't worry, it won't affect these people over here who don't do business in the UAE, you know, whatever. And then they're like, yeah, we'll change the rules for most of the people. So I get there's a whole contingent of people who like are in love with Dubai. And if you're in love with Dubai and you want to move there and you can get a residence permit, you set up a company. I think the talent there is extraordinarily overpriced and extraordinarily overrated. There's not a lot of great talent there, as you might think. Maybe in the tech space, you can get that somewhere else for a lot cheaper. I don't dislike Dubai, like going there. I just think it's overrated. And if it's worth you paying 9%, I'm not against you paying tax, but you're not going to get a citizenship. It was 0% not very long ago. So I don't, you know, they just, you're paying 9% to money they don't need to appease powers that be. There's other places you can go. So, I mean, depending on the company you have, I mean, I always thought the Marshall Islands was a trash jurisdiction. But then we had people in blockchain businesses where it actually worked pretty well because it's very lightweight. You know, the British Virgin Islands for some companies works. Hong Kong is a bit more robust. You know, some people use US structures underneath or as part of, you know, international structures. I did a whole video on this recently where I talked about like reputation of jurisdictions and what it matters. I mean, if you're, you know, depending on if you're selling stuff to the general public and processing credit cards, or if you've got three clients and they just pay you via wire and they don't care where your bank is. So that's, I mean, that's what dictates best. But those are a handful of places. I'm not saying you should pay zero tax. My frustration, again, I think on the corporate side, it makes things easier. Pay tax based on where you live. If you want to live in Dubai, look at the 9% corporate tax for most businesses now as almost a sort of personal tax because you're going to one jurisdiction to solve both problems. For me, I don't want to necessarily live where my business lives. I don't want to live where my assets live. I live in Malaysia in the winter. I have a home there. I have a residence permit there. And I think the banks are very safe. They don't offer nearly the functions that a Singaporean bank would. I like going to Singapore. I guess if I was an Uber billionaire, maybe I'd live there. But there's still something that's just kind of more laissez-faire about Malaysia than there is in Singapore. But I don't want to live in Singapore. I want my assets to live there. I don't want to live in Hong Kong. Maybe my company could live there. Or the British Virgin Islands. If I had part of a bigger structure, I'd have small business, or I was only getting wire payments, that could work. So, I mean, there's so many levers.
Yeah,
there's somebody for whom Belize or Marshall Islands, kind of rather disreputable jurisdictions, that works for. If you're thinking, oh, look, there's absolutely no requirements whatsoever. It's just you pay $700 and you're in. That's when you're going to get in trouble because you can't process your credit cards. You know, banks aren't going to want to open your account. You need banking in Dominica or some little island with some little low rent bank that charges you $200 to send a wire. And you're going to be like, what the hell is this? Well, you probably should have stepped up one level of jurisdiction. But again, I mean, so there's something best for everybody. I think that the idea is you don't want to mix where you live, where your asset lives, where your business lives. People think, oh, I'm from the US, I'm a US LLC. Well, it's not how it works internationally.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're also remote and our business is in the US, but I'm traveling quite a bit. And I think a lot of people that are listening are probably going to be freelancers, consultants, maybe people that have remote employees, especially in the world of digital nomads.
Yeah.
So for those people,
which is a whole different set of tax systems. I mean, there's different countries that are like, hey, get a digital nomad visa, and you know, we've been special, not all of them, but some of them like, hey, we have a special regime for tax for digital nomads or freelancers or, you know, one man, one woman shows. So that's different from where to incorporate. In some cases, incorporating as a freelancer would be a bad idea. As an American, it's really not possible. You are that, you know, you're not a business in the IRS's mind. So again, I mean, so much nuance, yeah.
Yeah, totally. Can you still, though, as you mentioned, having a separate place from a business to where you live, let's say you mentioned Dubai, British Virgin Islands, Hong Kong is kind of the good ones to check out.
Oh, yeah, they're commonly used options.
Right, right. Can you just have incorporations there and pay whatever the 9%, let's say in Dubai, for your business, but then you handle your separate taxes somewhere else? Like, can you just separate those two and it's fine? Or do you have to base yourself somehow in Dubai, Hong Kong, or the British Virgin Islands, like an office or something there?
Yeah. So, and by the way, I mean, the UAE is a country, and there's free zones all over the country, including in Dubai and elsewhere. They've implemented for many businesses a 9% tax. The British Virgin Islands, Belize, et cetera, are still 0% tax. Countries like, their jurisdictions like Hong Kong have a two-tier system. If you live there, you pay. If you don't live there, you don't pay. I'm simplifying it. So can you, if I set up a U.S. C Corp, for example, no matter where I live, I'm paying U.S. tax on the corporate profits. Now, there's a way I could take a salary out, and that's sometimes people think they're smart. Like, I'll just take a multi-million dollar salary out of the UAE or out of my U.S. C Corp. Like, there's some rules on salaries generally. But if I have a C Corp, or if I have whatever the equivalent of a C Corp is, a limited company in most countries. In some countries, they call it an LLC, but it's the same as a C Corp by U.S. tax standards because it's taxed at the corporate level. You're going to pay. Like, I can start an Australian company tomorrow. They don't care if I live there. It gives me no immigration privileges. I don't get to go and live in Australia because I started a company. But if I start an Australian PTY Limited, I'm on the hook for tax. U.S. LLCs are a little bit different, but there's a lot of kind of confusion there. But my point is, have a place where it's zero tax would be what I would do personally. It's try and get the main operating company, maybe not your staffing company, maybe not the company that received your payments if you have a more complex structure, but your main operating company, where everything flows up to, would ideally be at zero. And then you go and you live somewhere. So, again, if you start a company in Hong Kong, and you were to go under Portugal's now shuttered NHR tax regime, that company's blacklisted. So either you move, you don't set up in Hong Kong or the BVI, or you choose somewhere other than Portugal because they conflict, or you pay some ridiculous penalty rate. You could go to Italy under the lump sum, pay them the 100,000. You could go to Ireland under the non-dom. You could go to Malaysia and just be a territorial taxpayer. You could go to Vanuatu where they don't have any income tax and you'd be fine. So you can lever up one or the other. I mean, you could live in tax-free Vanuatu and you could put your company as a U.S. C Corp. Why would you do that? I'm not a guy who's ever raised money. It's not really my thing. So I guess, if you're raising money from U.S. VCs, they might want that Delaware C Corp structure. But you can lever up the personal tax or the corporate tax as much as you want. The challenge is if you lever up both, you might have, depending on what those countries are, kind of conflicting tax systems, and you may not have tax relief. So I think that like the U.S. MLC, the beauty of it for Americans who are aware of LLCs, it's just a single tax, it's one tax bill. The problem is that, you pay a very high personal income tax rates if you are an American or if you live in the United States. And so I would apply that same principle of kind of having the LLC, like look at your company to pass through. It's not if it's a C Corp equivalent, but look at it as the company shouldn't pay, you pay. And then you can control the lever of where it is that you pay and you can go to whatever tax system you want. And if it's worth you paying $100,000 to live in Italy, go ahead.
You mentioned C Corp. A lot of probably tech entrepreneurs are C Corps, right? Because of the way the VCs are set up. You mentioned the trap of paying a high salary. Then how would one pay themselves if they shouldn't just pay a high salary? Like, I know someone that has like a marketing company and the company pays the marketing company, which they own wholly. And then they pay themselves like a very minimal salary to bypass that. There seems like a lot of different ways to do that. Obviously, it's not tax advice.
I think we're getting this is what we do. Obviously, you can go to nomadcapitalist.com and no two plans are really the same. There's just so much to look at. My concern is whenever I hear like, oh, I just do this, so I get the multi pension plans, one we heard about a couple of years ago, and then it's like, oh, that doesn't work. All these kind of like tricks don't work. I'm not a fan of tricks, if that's what we're talking about. Like, to me, it's just, number one, the tricks can backfire. The tricks can get you in trouble. The tricks may be too aggressive. In the U.S., you can do whatever you want, your taxes, and they get to evaluate it. And people do aggressive stuff and they come back on them. So, I mean, I just think the answer is, if you want my school of thought, the nomad capitalist way of operating a business is you have the company in a tax neutral jurisdiction, unless you have some reason why, again, you want to live in the UAE and you want the company to pay 9%, you just kind of call, you're chalking that up to like, you're paying the 9% personally. Like that's the price of admission to live there, which is why I wouldn't have my company in the UAE anymore if I didn't want to live there. People just thought, oh, it's a good place to just to put my company in kind of the middle of the world and I won't live there. Why would you pay 9% to not live somewhere when you can pay zero and actually have more banking options? So if you want to do it my way, we don't have companies in the US. Oh, but I have venture investors. Listen, that's not my way. I teach a different way. Now, we've figured out some strategies, I think, with some of our US tax lawyers of how the venture investors, if they went along with certain strategies, the entrepreneur could greatly reduce their tax and then the investors maybe come along for the ride on that. But it seems like a lot of those venture guys don't want to do that. So that's why venture-backed clients have been probably some of our least successful clients because they're not willing to do anything or they're not able to do anything that it takes to actually, you know, get in the system. You can't change nothing and expect a result. So my philosophy is I wanted to change as much as possible. I wanted to change where I live. I wanted to change where my company lived. I wanted to, you know, hire employees that were in friendly places. You know, if you don't want to do any of those things, maybe go where you're treated best isn't for you. And you know, Alex Hormozdi and I have a friendly relationship. I mean, he made a video saying something like he pays, you know, 0% on 57% of his income and it's worth it. Like he's happy to pay the high taxes. He gets the networking. He gets to be in a country. We don't agree on that. I respect him. We don't agree. We don't share the same opinion that being in the US adds that much value. And you know, I guess another type of person we've seen kind of that's been somewhat less successful are children of immigrants, which I think he is, because there's this whole thing of like, hey, we finally made it to the promised land. But you know, you got to change what I call the tax friendly quadrant. Where are you leaving? Where are you arriving? Where's your business leaving? Where's your business arriving? That's the way you optimize, the way I would optimize this stuff. And again, you can get it down to zero, even if you're an American in some cases. If you're not an American, you can probably get it down to zero anytime. Or you can say, you know, it's worth me paying 2%, or I'll pay up to $100,000, or I'll pay this, or I'll, you know, and then you get to choose.
Yeah. This kind of gets into the whole philosophy of wealth building. I know you've got a good set of videos and articles around that, but you, at this point, you advise, you know, decamillionaires, centimillionaires. I don't know if you've advised billionaires that are helping them.
Yeah, a few. And some regular millionaires, but yeah, billionaires to billionaires, yeah.
A lot of wealthy people that I'm sure you've kind of seen patterns that maybe, you know, you're also doing very successful as well, but obviously you've had a plethora of clients that have gone through. What are some of the lessons that you've learned on how people listening can build their wealth faster?
Well, I mean, my philosophy is the fastest way to build your wealth is to reduce the biggest expense you have is taxes. And so, I mean, businesses cut at every line item. They don't look at optimizing for tax. I mean, big businesses do, but small businesses generally don't. And then they kind of say, oh, well, you know, that's the price of admission in the United States. That's the biggest line item any business has, generally even bigger than payroll in many companies, if you're profitable. And so you have more money to invest. You grow your money faster. It's a pretty simple philosophy. I mean, that's what I've seen from the most successful people. I've been building businesses for 20 years. I've been doing this for, I guess it'll be 12 years at the end of this year. I did not become wealthy overnight. It does snowball a little bit over time. But, you know, just every year, I'm just plugging away. And up until recently, I spent every year thinking, maybe this will be the end. Maybe this will be the year that my skills run out and it all comes falling down. And that's just how I'm wired. And I see some of that in the most successful people. When you look at kind of the person, you know, we've had a number of you know, hot shots that we've got we brought in a guy a while back who kind of really got rid of this in the business where, you know, they make $1 million a year for a couple of years, but they've got some hack or some trick and then it fizzles and then they get angry. And sometimes we're serving them while it fizzles and then they get angry at us. And then they start blaming us. We won't give them their money back. Like, you just got the passport, man. Like, I'm sorry, your business collapsed. 'Cause it was just built on some kind of hack. I mean, the people who are the most successful, they don't have a hack. People who are the most successful, the most gracious. I've stood in the living room of two different billionaires who endlessly praised me. My wife stood there once and she's like, you're going to go home. This is years ago. I don't really look at the comments anymore, but 5 years ago, she's like, you're going to go home and look at fart sniffer 782 calling you a scumbag. Here's a guy who's an inspiration to people who said that you're spectacular and he loves what you're doing. And he hired KPMG. They let him down and he thinks that you've got a unique approach. So they do that. I think they did it, you know, bit by bit. We've got a lot of, you know, crypto and Bitcoin people, and I love many of them. But it's the ones who like had the discipline to keep going for years, and who really believe in it that I like. You know, the guys who traded some altcoin for the last 3 months and they went from $7,000 to $2.2 million. They don't get it as much. And I think that they probably won't in many cases hold on to that well. So, if I look at repeat clients, the ones who they keep coming back to us, that's what they do. There's a humility. There's a kindness. There's a patience. There's this kind of almost kind of what you'd see when I live in Asia, this kind of generational wealth mindset. Maybe they're not going to give it to their kids, but they're building for the next generation. They're not building for the next quarter. And you know what? I just heard this yesterday. You know, companies in the U.S. are laying people off. Listen, corporations are going to be corporations. They're going to be soulless. But I think if you want to do the right thing, people in your life, people in your business, reducing your taxes gives you a lot more opportunity to make sure that when things slow down, you have the opportunity to make sure people can stay in business. We've never done a layoff in the history of our company. I never would. We don't need to. We're a profitable cash flowing company to begin with. But the fact that, you know, 40% of that from me and the company doesn't go to some soul sucking bureaucracy to go and bomb people or give to people who hate me and think that I'm an evil person because I built a business. That really makes a difference.
Yeah. Yeah. I think those are great points. Same question, but what about the mindset and habits to actually hold on to money, right? You talked about the altcoin people that may get rich from this crypto cycle or they came into a fortune, but they can't really keep it. What do people do to actually hold on to that money? Because sometimes that's harder for some people just because they don't have the mindset of being able to hold on to the money or investing properly. What are some of the things that you practice or that you've seen been practiced?
I'm not against the altcoin people. I just think that for me, there's lessons that you learn from 20 years of getting your teeth kicked in.
Yeah.
And what you realize is the people who think small, people who leave the comments, nothing bad's ever happened to them. They're miserable, but I mean, they haven't had some of the problems. Like an employee never was upset with them or something. It's like, yeah, you don't have any employees. You know, meanwhile, I talked to a guy, he's like, he had 1,000 employees. He's like, oh, I've sued by my employees, like, you know, 12 times or something, which still seemed like for so many years for 1,000 people, like, I haven't had that problem, but, it still seemed like, okay, like in the grand scheme of things, like it's actually not so terrible in a country like the US, but like some people would say, oh, that guy's a terrible guy. So like, you don't have that discernment when you just struck it rich overnight because you've never, like, I see being more successful how, like whenever I see some story, some business owner did some terrible thing. I'm like, okay, sometimes it is terrible. I'm not saying there's, there's scummy business owners, but I bet a lot of the time it's like, yeah, I kind of think I could figure out what happened there. And the person wasn't trying to screw anybody. And like, you know, the average person's an employee or the average person's just angry, but the average person doesn't understand how that works or this works. And it kind of got like just talked about in a way that's not entirely accurate. And now people are going after him. And so I think you have to have that mindset, just like, taking, the kicks to the groin, taking the kicks to the teeth over the years, and you learn stuff that way. I think being diversified is important. So again, what I would say, I don't care if you have a business and all your money's in the business or all your money's in Bitcoin. Obviously, some of the most successful people in the world, I mean, Elon Musk, I guess, is pretty well all in on his businesses. I look at that and say, are the odds are that I'm going to be Elon Musk or not? Pretty smart guy. I don't think I'm good enough to be that. And as Alex Hormozi, I think, has said, I'm paraphrasing, I'll take the 80% chance that over X years, I can have $50 million or $100 million. And then you get to find, okay, probably $250 million or whatever. I'll take that chance. But I think that's easy enough that anyone can learn the skills. And over time, by getting kicked in the teeth for enough years, can get to some great level of wealth. $30 million, you're an ultra high net worth individual. There's only about 600,000 of them, plus probably some crooked politicians and some mysterious Bitcoin holders. So, you know, call it 1 million or 2 million people in the world. You're in the top echelon if you get to $30 million. I think it's attainable over time, but you can't have a TikTok attention span and you have to enjoy the journey. And that's what the successful people do. They're not doing it so they can get out of it eventually, like a mob gig or something. Like, once I get it up, I'm getting out for good. What would I do if I got out for good? I'd still be looking for passports, and I'd be a nobody. Nobody would want to talk to me that. So why would I get out? I like what I'm doing. I believe in it. It has an impact. But I still want to be diversified. So just to say I'm going to put all my money in my business. No, what if the business has a problem? Don't get to a $250 million valuation and not have a couple bucks set aside, not have a couple properties, not have some money that you can start over with. And I think that the mindset that I would have is I don't believe in myself. I guess I believe in myself enough, but to take the risks. But I never saw it as believing myself. I saw it as I have no other choice. It's a sickness almost being an entrepreneur. I can't get a job. No one would hire me. I'm not hireable. I would never be promoted. I'm not, I wouldn't play the corporate game. I'd be the janitor 20 years from now. And nothing wrong with that. That's not what I want. So for me, I just like the diversification and the mindset of, hey, this may not work forever. No matter how smart I am, everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the face. That's why I like to have some lifestyle real estate. That's why I like to have some dividend stocks. I don't anymore want to live off the money generated by my company. I'll live off the quote unquote passive income from boring stuff. Let the growth stock be the growth stock. But I'm not going all in on any growth stock, even if I run it.
Yeah. Before I ask my last question, Andrew, I just want to acknowledge you for the incredible advice that you share online, the message that you have. It really shifts people to think in a different way. I remember when I first discovered your content, I was in a plethora of people talking about, $1,000 a month, living in Thailand, working on your laptop. And there wasn't really anyone that I could resonate with that was doing big things, thinking big, ambitious, but also living the type of, nomad capitalist lifestyle that you preach and the community that you've built. So first of all, I just want to share how much I appreciate the work that you do, because it's really shifted me. And I know this message is going to shift a lot of people. I want to make sure people check out Nomad Capitalist Live, which is the next event in Malaysia.
Yeah, so it's our second event. We do a 4-day annual get together. We do accept clients with a certain income or net worth, but for the event, anybody can come. And so it's a little bit of a premium event because there's no sponsors. The only revenue we get is selling tickets. But it's 4 days of our team explaining a lot of the stuff we're talking about with more examples, more details we could go into here. Obviously, still not tax advice, but you can talk to them as well. We've got, so a lot of talk about taxes, passports, all the stuff that we do. But also, the CEO of AirAsia is coming, Tony Fernandez. I thought he bought the airline for $1 million. I actually was corrected. He bought it for 1 Malaysian ringgit. And he turned it into this, billions and billions of dollars.
Wow.
I've been listening to too many Americans for too long. Nothing wrong with that. But like I said, let's really focus on hearing from entrepreneurs. Boosie. I'll butcher his last name, but Boosie from South Africa. Everybody I know in South Africa, we love Boosie. Tony Fernandez from Malaysia built AirAsia from nothing. We've got, Nigel Farage before political, what's happening in the West. His bank account got closed just because they don't agree with him. So it's all that kind of stuff. It's a lot of like-minded people. It's hundreds of folks from around the world. It's our team, which is very diverse from around the world. You'll learn about all the best places. We've got emerging markets, investment experts, guys who are actually investing in Africa, Uzbekistan, Vietnam, Colombia, and they're doing so successfully. People who are living in places around the world. They're on panels. You're going to hear from them and they're going to be mingling and talking. So it's kind of the ultimate, nomad capitalist, global citizenship for entrepreneurs, for investors, for successful people. What do you need to know? Who do you need to meet? It's kind of like my curation of everything you should know. And that's coming up September 25 through 28, Nomad Capitalist Live.
Great. Yeah. And I think the YouTube channel is also a plethora of resources. The book as well, Nomad Capitalist. We'll have all those linked down for people to check out. One of the things I really appreciate this conversation is just such a unique fresh of air around how you define success, because everybody has their own personal journey. How do you personally define success for yourself?
I think it evolves over time. And that's why, you know, your aforementioned question, the mindset of those very successful people who get to $100 million, $200 million, $500 million, I met them. They're not really that much different if it happened over time, right? And you may see all the company went public and they got $500 million. But obviously it was a long time coming. For me, as a kid, I looked at success as financial. And I think financial success is success. I think it's important. It buys a lot of freedom. It gives you opportunities. But I think success is being a leader, whatever it is. So, you know, if you're single, do people want to, you know, follow you? There's this idea that, oh, if you have money, women just want to be with you. I don't think that's true. I don't think if you won the lottery, I mean, you get a certain number of people, but the average like quality woman would not find that interesting. The average quality woman finds it interesting, like this person built something. And that's leadership. Leadership in your company. I think success is developing other people. This is the fifth law of leadership. It's like building other people. I've seen building a company. We now have 82 employees. We've had some that have lasted for quite a while. Some plateaued eventually. And what I saw when people plateaued and after years couldn't make it anymore was they couldn't build more leaders. They couldn't let go of their ego. They couldn't let go of their fear and build more leaders. That to me is not success, because they're living a life of fear, which is also not success. For me, I reached a personal financial milestone to where I said, I'm going to build the business as large as possible to have an impact because I believe in it. I do it myself, right? I mean, I sell the same things that I would want to buy. I built the service that I would want. And so now the thing is, who's in my trusted inner circle? How do I help them become more successful? How do I help everyone in my company through better trainings learn things that they wouldn't learn somewhere else? And I always kind of thought people in the various industries that we're in kind of looked down at us. Oh, they're just the YouTube guys. We hired a few people recently. They're like, oh my God, they're in awe of you, what you do. And I think we kind of lose sight of that sometimes. Of like, you know, if you're a leader, people are attracted to what you do. And I haven't always paid enough attention to the positive sides of that. But I think that you want to help other people develop. And I mean, the people that no longer work here that I'm most proud of are the ones that had no idea what a business is about when they started. And now they went out and started their own business because they were inspired here. I think that's success. So I think that, you know, for me, that's kind of the piece that's really impacting on me right now.
Andrew, thanks so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.